right, so tonight we're going to shift our attention to another category of psalms that are sometimes called historical psalms. Or I've seen in some commentaries they refer to them as psalms of remembrance. And the reason for this is because these are psalms which spend most of their attention focusing on retelling the story of Israel's history. Almost every culture has songs like this. I've joked with you before about Johnny Horton's old song, The Battle of New Orleans, where he retells the story of the Battle of New Orleans. And almost every culture has songs like this in it, and Israel was no exception. But of course, in the case of Israel's songs, these reflections on Israel's past are designed to teach a lesson. Just like any time we study the Bible, we are studying the past. And any time we study the Bible, we're drawing lessons from the past to apply to our own day and time. That's what these psalms are doing as well. Now, the thing is that depending on the angle of these psalms could be praising God or thanking God for what he's done in the past. They could be focusing on what God has done in the past as king. They could be focusing on what God has done for Zion, for Jerusalem in the past. And so for that reason, sometimes these same psalms are categorized by other types, like as praise or thanks. So I'll show you an example. Earlier in our time studying the psalms, we read through Psalm 136. So I want you to take a moment and look over there. You may recall this was the psalm where I read the first line and you responded back with the line that is repeated all through this psalm, which is, "For his steadfast love endures forever," or words to that effect. Now, this psalm is usually categorized as a thanksgiving psalm because it starts off, "Give thanks to the Lord." It's always a really good indicator to look for. But what this psalm is giving thanks for is, as you just reflect down through the psalm, particularly starting at verse 10, it tells the story of Israel's history and what God did in the Exodus and in saving the people in the wars against the Amorites and the conquest and so forth. So is that a thanksgiving psalm or is that a historical psalm? Well, it could be considered both. And in different commentaries, you'll see it described in a different way. I'll show you another example of what I'm talking about, how these psalms, you know, may fall under multiple categories. Look back at Psalm 95 for a minute. I don't think we studied this one in class, but I have referred to it. Psalm 95 starts off like a praise or thanksgiving psalm. So it says, "O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let's make a joyful noise to him with a song of praise." So that starts off like your typical praise hymn or thanksgiving hymn, right? But then notice, how does it describe God in verse 3? Yeah, as a great king. So look at the categories we've studied so far. It could also qualify as a royal psalm because it's focusing on praising God or thanking God by virtue of the fact that he is a king. And then if you shift here, notice in verse 8, "Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah on the day at Massah when your fathers put me to the test." Well, now this almost sounds like a lament where you're talking about a national failure, a national sin. So the point I'm getting across is, as I've said many times in this class, there's no table of contents that categorizes the Psalms like this. This is just our way of trying to get a handle on the basic stylistic features of these categories. And some Psalms could fall into multiple categories. Another category, which is the category we're going to study next, we haven't studied this yet, is the wisdom psalms. And a wisdom psalm is a psalm that sounds like it could be Proverbs. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the godly, or stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on it he meditates day and night. That sounds a lot like Proverbs to me. Well, that's why Psalm 1 is often considered a wisdom psalm. Well, think about it. Why would you retell the nation's history? Why would you tell a story from the nation's past? To draw a lesson, to make the people you're writing to wiser, so either they don't make the mistake or they follow the example of faithfulness, right? So that's why sometimes these psalms are categorized as wisdom psalms as well. But I thought we could take time, we'll take two class sessions today and Lord willing on Sunday, and we'll look at a couple of these psalms for no other reason than because they help us see how a Bible writer looks at stories from Israel and draws lessons. How many sermons are like that, right? I've preached on David and Bathsheba. Mickey did a table talk on the bronze serpent. We all do this, right? We all look back to these stories and we draw lessons. Well, here's an example of an inspired writer doing that very thing. And the psalm that I've picked tonight, I picked in part because it reflects on so many of the stories we've been reading. If you've been doing the daily Bible reading or following some Bible reading schedule that has been taking you through Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. So let's go to the first one up here on the slide tonight, which is Psalm 78. And that's where we're going to spend the rest of our time tonight. How's the memorizing going? I've gotten messages from a couple of you. I'm working on it. Somebody, Paul Gregory, printed his out and taped it on his truck. And just make sure you're, you know, focusing on your driving. Maybe that's what's going on out of here, is people are memorizing scriptures, you know, and I get angry at them. But maybe that's why they drive erratically, or maybe tape it up. I've got it printed out right next to my computer screen on a little stand, so I can just kind of keep it in front of me. But we're trying to memorize Psalm 117 before Sunday as an exercise in meditation, which, by the way, is how this psalm starts off, almost in a meditative form, when it says, "Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the word of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable." That's what mine says. I tried to check several translations. Is that what everybody says in verse 2, a parable? "And then I will utter," now here's where there will be some difference. ESV says, "dark sayings from of old." But NIV people, what does yours say? Ralph, you're usually my NIV go-to guy. You don't have your NIV with you tonight. Anybody else got it? All right. So it says hidden sayings, which is what's meant by dark. That's the idea behind it. It's something that's hidden in the dark. And so what he's basically saying is, we need to bring this back out into the bright light and remember it. This has kind of been sort of, this lesson's been down in a dark, dusty cabinet. We got to get this back out and get it in the spotlight and remember what the Lord has said. Also, by the way, notice in the title, which is, you know, just above verse 1, it gives us the name of the author. What's the author's name? Asaph. And then what is the word to describe what this psalm is? Yeah, now my Bible says a maskil, M-A-S-K-I-L. And then what did somebody else have? Yeah, the NIV has, excuse me, the New King James Version has contemplation. And that seems to be what this word actually refers to. The root word that it comes from means to understand, to derive insight. So it's a teaching psalm. And now you can understand more why people sometimes call these wisdom psalms, because you're trying to impart wisdom, right? Verse 2, "I will open my mouth in a parable, utter hidden sayings from of old." Verse 3, "things that we've heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation." Now that's interesting, right? Just within the span of verse 3 to verse 4, we've had three generations. Because there's our fathers, then by implication, us, and then we're not going to hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation. See that? Three generations. Remember when God gives his initial command in Deuteronomy 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God. Immediately after that command, what does the Lord tell Israel to do? Teach them to your children. When they get up, when they go down, when you're out, when you're in, right? Remember that? The religion that God gave Israel was very much supposed to be a religion in which you're constantly passing on what you've learned. It doesn't stop somewhere. It's a constant generation to generation kind of thing that is supposed to, that's supposed to take place. So verse 4 says, we will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation, and tell particularly what? The praise of the Lord, or the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. So hold your place here just for a second and look back at Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. I want you to see how very early on in Israel's histories, these kinds of songs were being sung. What do I mean? Songs that are retelling the story of what God has done for the people. So, what do we call this song here in Exodus chapter 15? It's the song of Moses, right? And what is the song of Moses about? It's about the deliverance from Egypt, right? So right here on the heels of the Exodus, there is this song of Moses where he sings about the Lord and what the Lord has done. And what I want you to notice is verse 11, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, is what mine says. And it's the same words found over here in Psalm 78 and verse 4. So there's an echo here. What I'm doing now is what Moses did back then. I'm going to sing you a song which rehearses, which retells the story of the mighty deeds that God has done. All right? Yes, sir. Yes. Right. Yeah, no, Joe's making the point that he watched the miniseries Roots, which for some of us of a certain age is like one of those series that's burned into your brain, right? But he was making the point that, you know, some of those African tribal cultures that maybe didn't have access to books, that the way they passed on information was through songs that they would pass on. And some of you came up in cultures like that. Southern culture is very much a storytelling culture. I was joking with somebody when I was in Alabama last week. There were three different times where I asked one of the older men a question. I said one question, and then I sat for 45 minutes while he spun a story, right? Well, now that's not just Southern culture, but it is sort of like that Scots, Irish, Southern culture. You're just natural storytellers. Well, so were the Israelites. So were the Africans. A lot of cultures have this kind of penchant for this. So that's a great point, Joe. It's a great way to see what's going on here. All right, so let's go back to Psalm 78. Now, this is a pretty long psalm. Matter of fact, it's the second longest in the entire collection. Only Psalm 119 is longer. So I'll try not to pick it apart too much so we can kind of get the main, you know, flow of this. What I want you to notice in verses 5 through 8, which I would still consider part of the introduction of the author saying, here's what I'm doing. Here's the story I'm going to tell you. Verse 5, he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach our children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children. So you see that? It's an intergenerational thing, but notice, it's not just to learn an abstract set of facts or a random collection of stories? What is it that is supposed to be passed on according to verse 7? Yes, that they should set their hope in God. Yeah, that's what this is supposed to be about. A couple of weeks ago, I preached about how Scripture draws us near to God so long as we are reading Scripture to learn about God, not just to collect raw data. And this is what happens sometimes with kids in college who lose the faith. The reality is they never really had faith. Oh, they may have gone to church every Sunday and Wednesday in high school. They may have filled out blanks in a Bible class book. They may have been able to repeat lists, 5 steps of salvation, 5 acts of worship, 3 works of the church, whatever, however you want to quantify those things. But it was never ingrained with them that what this is about is your relationship to God, your love and dedication to God above all things. And that's what the psalmist wants Israel to know. Verse 7, so they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers. So there's a positive thing they are to learn, set your hope on God. And there is a negative thing to learn, don't be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation. And as soon as you hear those words, you know, who is he talking about? Israel in the wilderness. Israel from Egypt in the wilderness. We know who he's talking about. Whose spirit was not faithful to God. Now, one other thing I want to point out here. In verse 8, my Bible says a generation whose heart was not steadfast, as if it just sort of happened to be the case that their heart was not steadfast. But the verbiage here is much more active. Those of you who use the New American Standard, there at the end of verse 8, a generation that did what? Did not prepare its heart. That's the problem. They didn't actively prepare their heart. The New King James says they didn't set its heart aright. So he's not saying, well, it just by random coincidence, their heart was not steadfast. No, they did not do what they were supposed to do to set their heart right to God. All right, everybody good up through verse 8? Yeah, Mickey?
How do you suppose these people didn't read and write that verse, right?
Right.
How do you suppose by starting early telling stories to your young kids is better than the actual eye of the parents that saw miracles? I've never understood how the ones that actually saw
right. 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 So Mickey's asking a really good question. How could it be sometimes that the generation that actually is the eyewitness seems to have a lower percentage of believers than the generation that comes next? And I think the answer to that, you know, we saw this a lot a couple of years ago when I preached all year through the Gospel of John, that in the Gospel of John, Jesus performs signs, but the problem is the classic example of this is the feeding of the 5,000. Those people saw an undeniable miracle, but what were they focused on? The food. It's the interpretation of the miracle, of its significance. It's what is so important, but a lot of times the eyewitnesses of miracles are so caught up in the superficial aspect of it, they don't see what the deeper meaning is. And I think that's a part of the reason why. Yeah. All right, so now then, he's going to tell us the story of their unfaithfulness. Who does he begin to pick on in verse 9? The Ephraimites. The Ephraimites, armed with the bow, turned back on the day of battle. Nobody is really exactly sure if there's a specific episode the psalmist has in mind here or not. So far as I can tell, there's not one story in the Bible where the Ephraimites really don't pan out. The one possibility to always keep in mind from the perspective, the big picture of Israel's history, is The tribe of Ephraim is the tribe that what notorious person came from? It's not Esau. He would have not been in the tribes of Jacob, although he was certainly a notorious person in his own right, for sure. Who is the one who caused all Israel to sin? And the Bible says it in the Old Testament about 8 gazillion times. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused all Israel to sin. When the nation breaks up, it's Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and he's from Ephraim. So a lot of times in the Old Testament, the prophets have a pretty dim view of Ephraim because of that. If I had to guess, it's something like that going on here, but I can't say that. I can't say that for sure. Anyhow, verse 10 says, they did not keep God's covenant, but refused to walk according to his law. They forgot his works and the wonders he had shown them. In the sight of their fathers, he performed wonders in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan, which are mentioned in our Bible reading in Numbers 13 and part of Egypt. He divided the sea and let them pass through it and made the waters stand like a heap. In the daytime, he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a fiery light. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused waters to flow down like rivers. But after all of the miracles of the liberation from Egypt and the miraculous provision, yet they still sin more against him, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. They tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. Now, remember what the food is that they craved? Well, he gives them manna, but it always cracks me up. You remember what some of the foods are? Yeah, that's right. We want to go back to get our melons and leeks. Cucumbers in the land of Egypt. Now I used to watch like Emeril and Rachel Ray's 30-minute meals, and I tried to go cook what they did, and she made leek soup. Let me just tell you about leeks. They are a pain in the neck to try to cook because they've got so much sand and grit. You gotta chop them up, wash them, rinse them, wash them, rinse them, wash them. On that principle alone, I wouldn't even want to fool with him here. But this must have been the thing for the Israelites. Notice in verse 19, they spoke against God, saying, can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. Anybody can do that. It seems to be anybody can make water come out. I want to see a full course spread out here. Can he also give bread or provide meat for his people? Well, guess what he does? What are the two things they say there at the end of verse 20? Can he give? Bread, meat. Guess what? Even though they do not deserve this, he gives them what they want. Therefore, verse 21, when the Lord heard, he was full of wrath. A fire was kindled against Jacob. His anger rose against Israel because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his saving power. See, that's the issue. Why is it that he says you got to teach your kids to trust in God? Because this is the issue. It's not just a set of facts. They've got to know who God is. Yet, so there's the yet in verse 17, yet they sinned. Yet, verse 23, he commanded. Isn't that great? It's the thing we don't always know about God. No matter how sinful we are, he's always more gracious. Always more gracious. So yet he commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, which means the Bible is making it clear this food that they're about to get did not come from a natural source. That is the language that resounds with divine origin. God commanded the skies and the doors of heaven open. Verse 24, he rained down. So now it's the quantity. He rained down on them manna to eat and gave them the grain of heaven. Man ate the bread of what? The angels. I think the New American Standard Bible has a footnote that says what? Any of y'all use your New American Standard, check the footnotes? It's got really good. One thing I would give the NASB an advantage over the ESV, its footnotes are great. They should have just put the footnotes in the actual text more often. But you should have a footnote there that says mighty men, So the idea is this is food that's just the greatest food of all. He set them food in abundance. Verse 26, he caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, which remember that was the same wind, a strong east wind in the Exodus. And by his power led them out the south wind. He rained meat on them. So he rained down manna in verse 24. He rains down meat in verse 27. Meat on them like dust, winged birds like the sand of the seas. And by the way, that's an echo. It's an important echo. What is that an echo of? Like the sand of the seas. That's right. The promise to Abraham and the children. So you need to always be thinking in mind of these little echoes. We're seeing echoes back to the Exodus. We're seeing echoes back to Abraham. This all ties together, right? Verse 28, he let them fall in the midst of their camp and all around their dwellings. And they ate and were well filled, for he gave them what they craved. Remember, verse 20, can he give bread or provide meat? Yes, I'll even do that. You thought giving you water was no big deal? I'll take it a step forward. But verse 30, but before they had satisfied their craving, while the food was still in their mouths, the anger of God rose against them. And he killed the strongest of them and laid low the young men of Israel. Do you remember what the account in Numbers says about the food in their mouth? Yeah, let's go back and look at it here real quick, all right? Go back to Numbers chapter 11. Verse 31 says, then a wind from the Lord, this is Numbers 11, verse 31. Then a wind from the Lord sprang up, and it brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side, a day's journey on the other side around the camp, about 2 cubits above the ground. Talk about a rain, right? And the people rose all that day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. Those who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And we're supposed to, even if you don't know ancient Israelite metrics, obviously the point of the text is it was a bunch. But verse 33, while the meat was yet what? Between their teeth, they're still chewing it. Before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck them down with a very great plague. So that's what's being described here. But you know what? We almost didn't even have to have that detail because we've already seen this pattern in Psalm 78. The Lord is gracious, generous, blesses them, yet the people sin. So the Lord, yet the Lord is gracious and blesses them, yet the people sin. So you have this constant emphasis on the generosity and grace of God in contrast to the constant unfaithfulness of the people. All right, any questions or comments up through verse 31? All right, verse 32. In spite of all this, they still sinned. Despite of his wonders, they did not believe. So he made their days vanish like a breath, and their years in terror. When he killed them, they sought him. They repented and sought God earnestly. What period of Israel's history does that remind you of? So you've got the story of Korah, for sure, in Numbers. And what other period of Israel's history is a period of sinfulness, then there's punishment, then they repent and turn to God? Yeah, it'd be the story of Judges has a lot of that cyclical kind of feel to it. Verse 35, they remembered that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. So this sounds great. Guess what's going to happen? But, verse 36, but they flattered him or deceived him with their mouths. They lied to him with their tongues. Their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. There's an old adage, the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart. That's true with Israel here. And it just reinforces why our theme this quarter is drawing near to God. It's not enough just to come to church. It's not enough just to have a daily Bible reading program. It's not enough to go to Bible classes. All of those things are great, so long as they are a tool to coming to know God. But it kind of goes back to your question, Mickey. You know, your question was, how could people have seen so many miracles fall away from God. But you know, if you think about it, couldn't we ask the same kind of questions? How could people have heard so many sermons? How could people who've gone to so many Bible classes? How many people could have read so many verses? How could people have sung so many songs fall away? And the bottom line is going to be the same thing. It's not focusing on God as the object of our loyalty and our adoration. So that's what he says in verse 37. Their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. And we can also expect what's going to come next. Yet, but, yeah, they're unfaithful. God is gracious. Yet he, being compassionate, atoned for their iniquity and did not destroy them. He restrained his anger often. The New King James says, many a time. I like that. Many a time. The NIV says, wasn't there one of you in here? Time after time? Yeah. Time after time. It did not stir up all his wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh and a wind or a breath that passes and comes not again. God recognizes the frailty of humanity and the fact that humanity, even his people Israel, can fall into sin. Verse 40, how often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. They tested God again and again and provoked or pained or limited the Holy One of Israel. Thus they did not remember his power or the day when he redeemed them from the foe. So they don't remember what God has done. And even when they do think about what he's done, they quickly turn it into what they're going to get from it rather than coming to know God and to understand God. Any questions up through verse 42 so far? It is very weird. I can't raise, because I busted up my shoulder, I can't raise my arm really right now, so I can't gesticulate. So I'm a one. It's very weird to only be, how do you left-handed people do it? It doesn't feel right. Doesn't make any sense. It's kind of funny. I digress here just for a minute. One other time I fell, but when you're a big guy, a lot of times when you fall, it's like it happens in slow motion. Like you have complete thoughts, complete sentences go through your mind. Like, what happened? I'm falling. How long am I going to fall? When am I going to land? That was the last time. But man, last night, it was kaboom. It was like more like a cartoon than anything else here. All right, so look through verse 43 kind of brings up signs in Egypt, marvels in the fields of Zoan, which, by the way, this kind of repetition, sometimes we wonder, why does it repeat things like this? For the very reasons that Joe mentioned, so that people learning by ear, you've got some repetition in these stories. But if you start at verse 44 and go through verse 51, what aspect of God's marvels against the foe does he talk about? Yeah, obviously it's the plagues here, right? So verse 44, he turned their rivers to blood so they could not drink of their streams. He set among them swarms of flies, which devoured them, and frogs, which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locust, and the fruit of their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail, and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail, and their flocks to thunderbolts. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt, the firstfruits of their strength and the tents of Ham. And that reminds us that the people of Egypt would be one of the offspring of Ham from the story of Noah. So that's what God did to the bad guys. And now here he talks about what the Lord has done for his own people. So he says in verse 52, then he led out his people like what? So there's a common metaphor all through the Bible of God, of kings, of Moses, and of course of the Lord Jesus as shepherds, and a common metaphor, the people of God as a flock. Verse 53, he led them in safety so that they were not afraid, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And he brought them to his holy land, to the mountain which his right hand had won. He drove out the nations before them. He apportioned them for a possession and settled the tribes of Israel in their tents. And after all of those wonderful descriptions of all the good things God has done, guess what's going to come next? Yet. But. Verse 56. Yet they tested and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned away and acted treacherously like their fathers. They twisted like, mine says, a deceitful bow. So it's kind of like, imagine a bow, but either the wood part or the string is twisted so that when you shoot, you don't have any idea where it's going to go. And of course, in battle, that's going to be treacherous to you. So it's a crooked thing that can deceive you and that can betray you and that is treacherous. So that's what Israel is like. They're crooked, we might say. Verse 58. For they provoked him to anger with their high places. They moved him to jealousy with their idols. When God heard, he was full of wrath and utterly rejected Israel. He forsook his dwelling at Shiloh, the tent where he dwelt among mankind. Do you remember what story he's talking about that took place in Shiloh? Now, some of you guys have recently studied history and geography of the Old Testament. Hasn't been that long ago. So you, some of y'all should remember this. What terrible event happened at Shiloh? Well, no, that's not the one that happens there, although that does happen in another story. This is the story where the Philistines are at war with the Israelites, and the wicked judge Eli thinks, hey, let's take the Ark of the Covenant into battle like a good luck charm. And you remember what happens? The Philistines capture it. That's exactly right. Eli, when he finds out about it, you remember what happened to him? Yeah, I'm not sure I want to bring up the details. It says he fell, and because he was old and fat, he broke his neck. I don't think after the story I just relayed, we need to get into all those details here tonight. And then 1 Samuel 4 goes on to say that his two sons were killed. And then is it his daughter or daughter-in-law is going to give birth? And she dies, but she names the child Ichabod. You remember what that means? The glory has departed. So all that happens in 1 Samuel 4. It's a terrible story. And then you may remember how the rest of the story goes. The Lord afflicts the Philistines with, you know, problems, plagues, and they turn the ark back. All right, so that's what it's talking about here. Verse 61, and delivered his power, to be an ark, to captivity, his glory to the hand of the foe. He gave his people over to the sword and vented his wrath on his heritage. Fire devoured young men and their young women had no marriage song because their husbands or their future husbands are dying. Verse 64, their priests fell by the sword and their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep like a strong man shouting because of wine, and he put his adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting shame. Now then, if you're going to tell the story of the Old Testament, what major figure comes on the scene after the story of Eli, Samuel, the Ark of the Covenant captured and then comes back? What major figure against the Philistines comes up next? David, that's right. So, verse 67, he rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, even though that was the biggest tribe. But he chose the tribe of Judah. Mount Zion, which he loves, he built his sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth which he has founded. Now, let me pause here. That could simply mean God built the earth and God built the sanctuary, and the same God who built the earth built the sanctuary. So like he built the earth, he built the sanctuary. It's possible that's all he means. But there's something else that a lot of commentators think he means. They think that he means that in some way the Lord modeled the tabernacle after the earth. Now, if you're thinking, well, where in the world does that come from? If you're doing the daily Bible reading, it hadn't been that long ago, we read through the description of the construction of the tabernacle. Matter of fact, we read those details twice, once when they were given and once when they were executed. Now, you would have to have a really good mind, a really good detail of memory. Do you remember in the curtains of the tabernacle, there's a certain color scheme that keeps coming up over and over again? Very good. blue, purple, those colors, blue and purple, we see those colors, colors like them, every sunset, especially here in Florida. You all have beautiful sunsets here in Florida. And not only that, you may recall that some of the figurines are aspects of nature, like the rod, the candelabra is like flowers and the cups of flowers. And then even engraved in when Solomon builds the temple, all of these things are actually engraved into the inner part of the temple. Some people think that part of the point is that he's saying that just like the Lord made the earth, in a similar way, he kind of designed the tabernacle to have kind of that same feel. Anyway, verse 70, he chose David his servant, took him from the sheepfolds, and from following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, Israel, and his inheritance. With upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand. And you may remember that when David was before Saul and he gave his resume as to why he should go fight Goliath, he drew on these experiences, right? What did he tell King Saul? Yeah, I had to fight the bear and I had to fight the lion, and that's what I did as a shepherd. So this is more than just the Lord gave me the victory over, you know, those terrible animals. It's that I know what it is to look out for the flock of God, and in a way to be a shepherd of his people. And so that's why a lot of times, not just in Israel, but in pagan cultures that had sort of the same agricultural, pastoral background. Some of you have seen a lot of ancient Egyptian artifacts, and you might remember when it shows the Egyptian king, like Tutankhamun, one of the things that always shows him with is with the shepherd's crook, the thing that looks like this. Because it was just a common thing in the ancient world to see kings as shepherds, but especially the kings from David, because he's the ultimate shepherd king, right? He literally was the shepherd. And then, of course, the Lord Jesus is the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. All right, so then, remember, he started off by saying, I got some wisdom to put on you. I'm going to tell you some things that have been hidden that we need to bring back out to light. And that is, we have a history of when God is gracious to us, forgetting him and turning from him. So don't make that mistake. Take to heart the responsibility we have from one generation to another to pass on loyalty to God. That's the only way to keep this from happening. And then also take to heart the fact that God is going to always be more gracious and giving than we could ever be sinful, and take encouragement from that. All right, so that's a classic historical psalm. We'll take a look at one other one, Lord willing, on Sunday morning.